Lecture 11, Democracy Restored, Cleisthenes of Athens.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. The period of the Pisistratid tyranny might have given Athens some relief from the faction fighting, as we've seen. But the fall of that tyranny in 510, with the expulsion of Hippias, led to almost immediate clashes between noble families. The sorts of clashes that have been constant throughout Athenian history to date. Faction strife among powerful families sounds like a cracked record to us by now. Will it ever end? Well, yes, it will. It will end, and we'll see how and why in this lecture. And it ends thanks to Cleisthenes and his round of democratic legislation in 508. When Hippias was expelled from Athens in 510, Cleisthenes, who was a member of that powerful family, the Alcmaeonidae, together with a certain Isagoras, whom the Athenian constitution says was a friend of the tyrants, went head to head. The struggle was centered once again on that all-important office, the eponymous archonship. Cleisthenes evidently was losing out because Isagoras was elected archon for 508. Now, elections for the archonship took place the year previously. So in 510, if we just recap chronology for a moment, in 510, Hippias was expelled. In 509, archon elections were held. Presumably it was Cleisthenes versus Isagoras, and Isagoras was elected archon and became archon for 508. Isagoras' days were numbered, however, because he enlisted the support of Sparta to help him maintain his power. This is rather odd. A Spartan force under King Cleomenes, that's the same king, by the way, who had expelled Hippias in 510, Cleomenes and another Spartan force invade Athens for the second time in as many years. They expelled 700 Athenian noble families that Isagoras had named. And the Spartans tried to set up an oligarchy of 300 men headed by Isagoras. So it doesn't appear as if Isagoras was going to be content with the one-year constitutional office that was the archonship. It looks as if he was after being set up as a tyrant of Athens, or rather as head of an oligarchy. It doesn't really matter, though. Cleomenes' invasion, and especially the attempt to set up an oligarchy, proved too much, and the Athenians rebelled. They besieged Isagoras and Cleomenes on the Acropolis for 2 days. They forced their surrender on the third day of the siege, and the two of them were forced to leave Athens. Now, according to the Athenian constitution, the resistance to Cleomenes and Isagoras began with the council, and then it spread to the people as a whole. This is important for the political power of the people at this time. This council, as the Athenian constitution calls it, cannot be the Areopagus. This would have been in favour of oligarchy, of course. This would have supported Isagoras. It was hardly likely to launch some sort of attempt against him. So the council then has to be the boule, the council of 400 established by Solon, which was the executive arm of the assembly. This was more representative of the people as a whole, and we can understand it's more likely to lead opposition. The boule had evidently resurrected itself fairly quickly, along with the assembly, no doubt, when the tyranny fell in 510. And it's the boule, then, that seems to have rallied the people against Cleomenes and the threat of oligarchy. So we have a democratic uprising against the threat of oligarchic power. And this speaks volumes for the power of the people compared to what that power had been before Solon. Now, after Cleomenes and Isagoras left Athens, the people recall Cleisthenes. When Cleisthenes had lost out during the struggles for the archonship, he'd been forced to withdraw from Attica. We don't know exactly how this happened, but he'd been ejected, presumably by Isagoras. Now, however, Cleisthenes was recalled by the people. And it's probably at this time that those families that Isagoras had asked Cleomenes to exile also returned. Now, the people as a whole, that means the assembly, made Cleisthenes leader and champion of the people. That's a direct quote from the Athenian Constitution. I've got to say it again because it's incredible when we think about the implications of this quotation for the power of the people. The assembly made Cleisthenes, according to the Athenian Constitution, quote, leader and champion of the people, and it placed all their trust in him. Now, this isn't a surprise, because the Athenian Constitution also tells us that he took the people into his group, into his following. So he was obviously losing out to Isagoras at the time, and he appealed to the people. In other words, he went after the people's support in his clash with Isagoras. Presumably, he promised them more democratic legislation, and they remembered that promise. Incidentally, in the phrase, he took the people into his group, or he took the people into his following, I hesitate to say that he attached the people to his party. This is sometimes how this part of the Athenian Constitution is translated. He attached the people to his party. I don't like the word party because it conjures up the idea of modern political parties, one being the party in power, the other being the one in opposition, each with its own platform, its own organization, constitution, agenda, and so on and so forth. There was nothing like this even in the developed Athenian democracy. In fact, how Athenian politicians marshaled their support is a bit of a mystery, would make an excellent MA thesis topic. For our purposes, and to put it crudely, Cleisthenes appealed to the people to support him in overthrowing Isagoras. And in return for this back-scratching, he presumably promised to scratch their backs with popular legislation. And so in 508, the Athenians brought him back, and they gave him some type of extraordinary power to fix the faction fighting, that fighting that was ever present in Athenian affairs and which caused such disruption to all sectors of society. Now, Cleisthenes was not an archon, so the assembly, and it has to be the assembly doing this. When the Athenian Constitution talks about the people, it means people in the technical sense of the assembly. So the assembly asked Cleisthenes to be another Solon, to fix things. The huge difference between Solon and Cleisthenes was that it was the people now, not the ruling aristocrats, not the Eupatridae, that gave Cleisthenes this mandate. Gosh, haven't the people come a long way since the days before 594? But how could Cleisthenes fix things when others before him had failed? Pisistratus had tried to neutralize aristocratic power in Attica, given how the aristocrats had dominated the areas in which they lived. The ordinary people were intimidated by their aristocratic neighbors. They kept looking to them for help, looking to them for support. Pisistratus, as we talked about in the previous two lectures, tried to centralize the position of power in Athens. He tried to centralize Athens in Attica to make the people look to Athens, not to the local aristocrats. He'd failed. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been faction fighting and the sort of problems that occurred when the tyranny fell. So how can Cleisthenes fix the problem? Well, he fixated on making the people no longer intimidated by the aristocrats in the areas in which they lived. He fixated on this by forgetting about centralizing Athens in Attica. That would come as a matter of course. What he wanted to do was to make the aristocrats impotent. Cleisthenes' legislation altered existing social conditions. It put an end to the influence of the aristocratic power bases in Attica. Well, surprise, surprise, an end to the influence of aristocratic power bases apart from his own, his family's own, the Alcmaeonidae, but you know, we have to expect some kickback. His legislation is wide sweeping, as was Solon's. And we're going to consider each aspect of it, political, social, economic, and so on, separately. We're also going to consider the view that it's Cleisthenes and not Solon who should be labelled the father of democracy. But we'll pick up on this in the next lecture. Cleisthenes took democracy to the masses in a way that Solon did not. So does that make him father of democracy? Remember that, though, as we track through the rest of this lecture and look at what the political legislation of Cleisthenes entailed. Now, I've got to warn you, this is complicated. This is going to be a tough lecture. But I did tell you in the very first lecture that we're going to be looking at history, the development of democracy and so on in detail. So this is the point where I suggest, you know, if you're driving your car now, listening to this on CD, pull over. Because what I'm going to be talking about for the next few minutes is going to be complex. In a nutshell, Cleisthenes mixed up the population of Attica, the entire population of Attica, into 10 new tribes. And how he did this was to take the existing four tribes, the four Ionian tribes, and create 10 new ones, just like that. Nobody knows why he came up with a number of 10, but he just did. And then he divided Attica into a number of administrative areas. The idea being that people's loyalty would no longer be to the aristocrats living in their towns, but their loyalty would be to their tribes, because he put the people into these 10 new tribes. And since members of the tribe would come from different parts of Attica, that means that somebody living in one town wouldn't be intimidated, because he could now call on fellow tribesmen who were living in other areas of Attica for support. Now, the people continued living in the same towns as before. There's a bit of a controversy about how many towns there were in Attica. Some people would argue for 169, others put the number as few as 139. But let's stick with more than 100 and less than 170. Then we can't go wrong. So there were more than 100 and less than 170 towns in Attica. Now, he didn't move people from one town to another. People continued living in the same towns as before. So there was no population displacement or anything like that. But individuals living in these towns now became part of a geographically scattered tribe. That was the nutshell. Now let me try to expand on it. Cleisthenes divided Attica into three regions: the city, the coast, and the inland, right? Three regions: the city, the coast, and the inland. We can see a bit of a similarity in these names with the three groups before the days that Pisistratus seized power: the men from the plain, the coast, and beyond the hills, the Diacria. So these are somewhat similar to those three factions, those three geographical groups in the days before Pisistratus. The city was the area in which the city of Athens and its suburbs were situated. Cleisthenes' city then was the city of Athens and its immediate suburbs. Cleisthenes' coast now ran along the entire coastline of Attica. In other words, it ran west and south of Athens to Cape Sunion, right at the tip of the Attic promontory, and then around the eastern coastline of Attica. So it really was all the coast. Cleisthenes' inland, now remember the old group was called the men beyond the hills, it's now the inland. The inland was now that chunk that was left. In other words, it was the chunk of land in between the western, southern, and eastern coastal areas up to the top of Attica, up to where its borders were with Boeotia. So there was a bit of an overlap between the pre-Pisistrated areas and the new ones of Cleisthenes, but Attica now stayed divided by this Cleisthenic system for the rest of its history. Now, Cleisthenes then subdivided each region. We have our three regions, the city, the coast, and the inland. He now subdivided each of these regions into 10 parts, or the Greek word here, trities. So that means that Attica is now divided into 30 parts. In other words, 10 parts for the city, 10 for the coast, 10 for the inland. 10 times 3 equals 30. Now, don't confuse these 10 trities, or parts per region, with the 10 new tribes. That's something different. We're talking about trities here. And to use a modern analogy, it might not work, but it gets the idea over. Compare this division to the states and counties within states in the USA. Each state is divided into another number of counties or parts. Now, these regions would not be the same size. Obviously, the city was smaller than the other two regions. And the inland is probably going to be the largest. And although each of them would have the same number of trities in them, 10 for each one, these trities would not be the same size. And they wouldn't have the same population, because some areas would have more towns than others. If I can try to use a modern analogy again, think of Maine, Texas, and Missouri. Now, I named these three states just because they're all different sizes. I'm not trying to suggest that because Maine is coastal, that it corresponds to Cleisthenes' coast region. And for the record, I've got nothing against the other 47 states, by the way. Think of Maine, Texas, and Missouri as the three regions of America. And each one of those is divided into 10 trities. Now, given the size of these states, or rather regions, some trities would be larger than others, and others would be smaller, depending on geographical features and population. Okay, so we now have Attica divided into the city, the coast, and the inland regions. Each region subdivided into 10 trities, so Attica becomes divided into 30 trities. Now for the next phase. The Athenians had long been divided into the four Ionian tribes. That's why the Salonian boule was made up of 400 men, 100 from each of the tribes. Cleisthenes expanded the number of tribes, as I said at the start of this lecture, from 4 to 10. And he gave each of his new tribes an eponymous hero that he, Cleisthenes, chose himself. In other words, he gave the new tribes pedigree. So there was a tribe called the Erechtheidae. This tribe was named after Erechtheus, who was one of the kings of Athens. Now, according to mythology, Erechtheus sacrificed his daughters to save Athens. Temple to Erechtheus, the Erechtheum on the Acropolis, stands as a tribute to him. There was another tribe too, the Antiochid tribe, which traced its ancestry to Antiochus, the son of Heracles. So you get some idea of what I'm talking about now. Nobody for a second would have thought that the tribe that they were now placed into actually went back to mythological times. But Cleisthenes was trying to give the tribe some pedigree, some so that the people would have some sense of belonging and pride to him. They hearkened back to what we might call good old days of Athens, if you like. Now, Cleisthenes Now turn to the towns of Attica. These towns were 139 or 169. I like to be vague about this because it really upsets people I know who are really specific about the numbers. Now, some of these towns were in the city region, others in the coast region, and the rest were in the inland region. Now we get to the core of what Cleisthenes was really up to. Because what he does now is he puts towns from different parts of each region into a specific treatise. And then he assigns treatises from different regions to the 10 tribes. See, I warned you it was hard to get a handle on what Cleisthenes did, at least the first time around. So let me try to explain this in a little bit more detail. And in what I'm going to say for the next 2 or 3 minutes or so, I should tell you that I'm making things up. Or rather, when I'm talking about names of towns and numbers of treatises, I'm actually just making them up sort of off the top of my head to illustrate the point I'm trying to get at, okay? So, for example, Cleisthenes might take towns in the city region that begin with, say, beta, towns beginning with kappa, and towns beginning with omicron, and assign them to treatise 1. Now, these towns were in different parts of the city region. For example, towns beginning with beta could be to its north. Towns beginning with kappa could be to the southwest. Towns beginning with omicron could be to the east. Doesn't really matter. Bottom line is that they were in different parts of that region. And he put them together now to make up treatise 1. So the area that's designated as treatise 1 came into being. Then he might take towns that began with alpha, towns that began with theta, and towns that began with sigma, and he assigned them to treatise 2. And he did the same thing to that city region until he had his 10 treatises. Then he did the same thing with the coast and inland regions, so that by the time he finished, all towns in Attica, all from different parts of their regions, were divided among 30 treatises, 10 per region. Each region had a different number of towns in it because of its size, just like if you divided up Texas, Maine, and Missouri into an equal number of treatises, you'd have a different number of towns in each one. So where are we right now? Well, let me give you a modern example to try to clarify the relationship of towns to treatises and regions. I, for example, live in Columbia, that would be the town, in Boone County, that would be the treatise, in Missouri, that's the region. But while people living in 2, 3, 5, or half a dozen towns found themselves suddenly being part of the same treatise, so what? Their towns hadn't moved, they were still living in the same house, and that theoretically meant that any aristocrats in town alpha of the inland could still dominate the ordinary people in that town, just as, say, any aristocrats in towns beginning with lambda of the coast region could do the same thing. Well, Cleisthenes hadn't finished. Remember those 10 new tribes? What he now did was to take one treatise from each region and assign it to a tribe, so that each tribe became composed of 3 different treatises. For example, and again, I'm making these numbers up. Don't anybody sue me if you're an expert on Cleisthenes' legislation. He might take city treatise 1 and coast treatise 4 and inland treatise 8 to make tribe 1. Then he might take city treatise 5 and coast treatise 9 and inland treatise 1 to make tribe 2. And so on and so forth until he had assigned all treatises to his 10 new tribes. Now, a treatise from one region was combined with another one from a different region, and then yet another one from the third region, and these 3 different geographical treatises together form a tribe. and each tribe would have in it a different number of towns, depending on how many towns there were in the various tridias of that tribe. Now, building on this system, Cleisthenes created assemblies for each tribe and for each town with regular meetings. So each tribe, each of those 10 new tribes, now had its own assembly. And the tribal assembly decided matters that affected that tribe, and it reported to the Athenian assembly. Moreover, it was the tribal assembly that elected the members of the boule by lot. Now, Cleisthenes will increase the boule to 500 at this point, 50 men from each of the 10 new tribes. 50 times 10 is 500. You see, you also get grade 3 math in this course. We'll talk about the boule a little bit more next lecture, all right? Now, let's go to the town level. Each town now has its own demarch, an official in charge of it, like a modern mayor. The name demarch is because the Greek word for town is deem. Remember Pisistratus's deem justices, the justices that travel from town to town? Now, each town also has its own assembly. It's a bit like a modern city council. And that deem assembly or town assembly decides matters that affect that town and reports to its tribal assembly. Now, all of the officials wanting to take part in the political process had to be elected, of course. But this new system gave people more protection thanks to the tribes. It allowed all citizens, regardless of where they lived in Attica, didn't matter if they were coastal, inland, or in the city, all citizens now were able to take part in the political process on a far wider basis than they'd been able to in the Solonian constitution. And they were able to do so because of the tribal assemblies that also elected representatives to the boule. Now you can argue that, and I do, that in the town and in the tribal and in the polis assemblies, that's all three, town assembly, tribal assembly, the big one in Athens, that what we have in effect in this three-tier hierarchy is the ancestor of the sort of administration that we take for granted today, sort of hierarchy of administration that we take for granted today, that is local, state, and federal administration. I don't think that's far-fetched. I know some people do, but I don't think it is. Even if the mechanics of it are different from then and now. Now, the assigning of towns to tritias and tritias to tribes sounds very arbitrary. Sounds like Cleisthenes has gone utterly mad. Where did he get this idea from? The answer's really easy. Are you ready? Three words. We don't know. But he came up with it. From nothing. It looks arbitrary, but it's not. There was nothing arbitrary about this system. It's brilliant. Cleisthenes didn't sit down with a sketch pad and draw 9 lines or however many are needed to divide each region into 10. And then he didn't just stick towns in them willy-nilly. He had a method to this apparent madness. What Cleisthenes had done was not merely redraw boundary lines as city councils do all the time today, especially school districts, just to give these councils something to do. No, in redrawing the map of Attica, what Cleisthenes had done was to make the tribes consist of people living in different areas of Attica that owed their loyalty to their tribe, and they were no longer prey to aristocrats living in their home areas. So it doesn't really matter now if Ned, that's a good Greek name, if Ned, who lives in the inland, is being intimidated in some way by aristocrat Joe, because Ned might be intimidated by aristocrat Joe, but Ned's fellow tribesmen who live in different areas of Attica, far away from aristocrat Joe, they're not going to be intimidated by him, and they're going to come to Ned's help. And I want to pick up on that in a little more detail in the next lecture. But I mentioned earlier that Cleisthenes introduced a wide array of legislation, not just political. And I want to discuss Cleisthenes' other legislation in our next lecture as well. And then by way of rounding off our discussion of Cleisthenes, we're going to try to answer two big questions. The first, did he do what he did because he was a genuine reformer, because he cared about the people and their political rights? And the second question, should he, and not Solon, really be labelled as the father of democracy? Now, this has been a tough lecture, I know. I promise you the next one will not be as tough. So there's no need to pour yourself a drink and roll your eyes before listening to the next one. Thank you very much for your attention. Bye for now.